Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
Hello, I'm James Reynolds. Welcome to The Documentary from the BBC World Service. In BBC OS Conversations, we bring people together to share their experiences. This time, after the announcement that Catherine, the Princess of Wales, has cancer, we talked to six young women about how being diagnosed with the disease changed their lives. When speaking about the news that she was being treated for cancer, Catherine, the Princess of Wales, sent a message to everyone else facing the disease not to lose hope. In this edition, then, young women around the world talk candidly about their own diagnosis, including how best to explain what's happening to them and to their kids.
After a few days, his friend came over to have a play, and I've overheard them saying, "My mummy has a poisonous rock in her boobie," so they chopped the boobie out, but now it's bionic.
According to research from the World Health Organization, one in five people will develop cancer in their lifetime. Many of those will survive, though there are various factors that will determine this, not least the quality of healthcare where you live. The WHO has said that the disease is the leading cause of death worldwide, accounting for nearly 10 million deaths in 2020. Medical researchers also suggest that globally, the number of people under 50 diagnosed with cancer has increased by 80% over the past three decades. There could be various factors for this, such as environmental or genetic causes, or we're just getting much better at spotting the condition early. You'd be forgiven for assuming that cancer is a disease of older generations, but that is not always the case, as we hear in this message.
So my name is Anna Biles. I am 36 years old. I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer in 2009 when I was just 21 years old. I was at the end of 4 years of study, literally about to finish my finals, and I don't think I presented in a sort of typical way for anything, really. I woke up one morning with a swelling in my neck, and I was encouraged by one of my lecturers to go and see a doctor, and they really didn't know what was wrong with me. I was sent from a GP straight to a hospital, and they initially diagnosed me with an infection in my thyroid because it was presenting as this odd lump in my neck. And I was sent home with some anti-inflammatories and given an outpatient appointment a month later. And unfortunately, that cycle sort of continued for me for about 4 months, where I would go back seeing an ENT consultant who continued to tell me that I had a infection in my thyroid, just to keep taking the anti-inflammatories and this lump would go down, which it didn't. And unfortunately, the turning point for me in realising I actually had cancer was I was watching a programme called The Secret Millionaire, and there was a young lady in that who had cancer of the thyroid. And I remember my heart just sank and I thought, that's what I've got. And we had to sort of take action a bit more swiftly, knowing that actually I'd had it at that point for about 4 months. I think for me, it was just a huge shock because I didn't know another young person who had cancer. And that feeling of you just hear the word cancer and at 21, it's quite a scary word. And you probably just instantly think that you're going to die. I was quite lucky in that I had the most fantastic consultant who, when I saw him and I had my diagnosis, he said to me, if you were going to get any cancer, this would be the one to have because it's very treatable and we will do everything we can. And I basically had 18 months of two operations. I had a very unusual form of radiation. I had to ingest a radioactive iodine tablet, which I did and took in isolation. And really, by the time I was 22, I was sort of leading a relatively normal life. But I hope now that diagnosis rates are better than they were when I was 21, because I certainly wasn't taken seriously. And I hope that younger people today, 15 years on, wouldn't have that same experience to get a diagnosis that I had.
Our next conversation, then, is with three women who were diagnosed with the disease as young adults. Naniki Siboni is 33, from Johannesburg, and also from South Africa is 31-year-old Michelle Fredman from Cape Town. They were joined in conversation by Savannah Farrell, who's also 33 and from Buffalo, New York in the United States. Naniki began our conversation by explaining how her cancer story goes back to her childhood.
I'm a stage 3 malignant melanoma survivor. I was diagnosed in 2015 at the age of 24. But my melanoma story doesn't start at diagnosis. It starts around the ages of 5 when I started experiencing severe and multiple nosebleeds, severe multiple sunburns. And at the time, my parents were kind of gesturing me to stop playing in the sun because I kept having all these skin issues. And then by the age of 7, 8, I developed my first notable mole. And this mole, I called it the jelly tot mole because it looked like the sweet jelly tot. And it didn't give me any issues except for the fact that it was unsightly. So I remember one time saying to my mom that we needed to get rid of it. And my mom decided that she would take a sewing thread and tie it around that mole in order for it to kind of suffocate and fall off, which it did. And I thought we were done with it. And then it came back and repeated the same exercise and we were done. By the time I got to varsity, I developed now another notable mole, which was a black mole. Now, this mole was very different to the other one. It had an irregular border and the color kept changing. You'd see it sometimes looking like a dark blue evolving into a black. Sometimes it would look dark brown. So it was quite unsightly in itself. And it just kept growing and evolving into such an unbearable thing that was on my leg. And when I speak to my black friends about it, they'd say, oh, no, you know, don't worry about it. But my white friends, my white lecturers, all looked at it with a matter of concern. And I couldn't understand it at the time when my doctors gave stage 3 malignant melanoma diagnosis that this was a telltale sign of skin cancer. You know, just cancer as a whole is not a discriminatory disease. And I had the misconception that skin cancer was a white person disease. So how could I, a black girl, be diagnosed with such a disease? So I now find myself doing advocacy work on melanoma awareness.
Naniki, you said cancer is not discriminatory. And Michelle, you're 31. You know exactly what that means about it being non-discriminatory. When you get a diagnosis so young, what kind of shock is that for you, Michelle?
It's a huge shock. For me, I was diagnosed when I was 22 in my second year of university. And for a university student at that age, you are busy, you're going out on the weekend. You know, you're such an active lifestyle that you don't think twice when you're very tired in the evening and, you know, you're overworked and you're fatigued. So for me, it was, you know, just a part of my normal life. And then I had a bronchial cough for a while and I started to have night sweats. I eventually went to the doctors and they all brushed it off. Just take some antibiotics, you'll be fine. But it persisted for a long time. And then eventually I was in the hospital and they found a lump in my neck and they biopsied the lump. And yeah, I had stage 2 Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is quite a common one in younger people. They used to say to me, oh, it's a good cancer, which is a bit of an oxymoron. But yeah, a huge shock. Like you said, for any age, but especially young, it's not in your periphery at all.
Let's hear now from Savannah, who's 33 in the States, our third guest. Savannah, how do your experiences compare to Michelle's and Naniki's?
So I was diagnosed only a year ago with triple negative breast cancer. I had no family history. I even got genetic testing. I have no known genetic factors for receiving this diagnosis. It was literally one day I'm sitting in negative 25 degree wind chill weather watching American football, cheering for the Buffalo Bills. And the next day I find a lump in my breast. I had my primary care doctor appointment 2 weeks after I found my lump for my annual physical. And it was the last thing I brought up because I didn't want to. I didn't really want to address the reality of the fact that it could be cancer. But luckily, my doctor said, it could be nothing, but you're over 30, so we're sending you for testing. And the place I got tested was very dismissive, too. The doctor that performed my biopsy was like, oh, it could just be an abscess. Like, have you been sick lately? And I was like, no, but also, not to be dramatic, I feel like it's growing. And so once I got the pathology back, it turns out it is the most aggressive form of breast cancer that you could have, other than obviously stage 4 once it's already metastasized. So I was diagnosed stage 2 triple negative breast cancer, and I went through 16 rounds of chemo. I had immunotherapy. I had a double mastectomy. And I actually have to go back on treatment in the next couple of weeks just to make sure everything really is killed off. But it was pretty shocking because I had to go from being very active, very social to pretty much being completely isolated for 6 months or very careful in terms of isolation. So yeah, it was wild.
Yeah. We've heard from all three of you the different experiences you've had with variations of the same condition. I wonder what thoughts or observations you have for each other.
Michelle, do you have something in relation to your family?
Yeah, I do. I've had quite a lot of cancer in the family. I wouldn't say it's genetic, the cancer I got, but there's definitely a pretendency towards cancer in the family, which I guess sets you up with more support. But at the same time, I think for most of us and most of society, it's when we're young, we consider it an older person's disease. And I think one of the hardest parts I experienced when I was in the hospital was because I was a little bit older than the kids' wards, I was put into the older ward. So suddenly you feel completely ostracized, not only from your age group, but also from the people you're surrounded with, because, you know, it's hard to relate to most people who are going through cancer at an older age. So you're kind of in that in-between zone. I don't know if you guys experienced that while going through chemotherapy or what your experience was like.
Definitely. I did experience that because I was, you know, 24, so not that much older than you at the time. Mm. And everybody else was just an older lady. And I think it was one of the reasons why I, you know, initiated to my doctors that I needed to leave. I needed to get out of the hospital.
Yeah.
There was nobody I could relate to.
I've noticed here, yeah. My hospital has a young adult program, which is pretty cool. And even a lot of my friends in the States that are going through treatment don't have that type of support within their hospital. So we have separate support groups. And then our young adult program offers us a lot of, it's not so much support as it is like almost mental distractions. Like I went to a knitting class the other day with a bunch of 25, 30 year olds. So like, it's funny too, because now I, you know, when I go in for infusion or whatever, I bring my knitting and I sit in the waiting room and I almost can relate to more people than not at that point. But yeah, it's definitely interesting because infusion, it was a lot of older people, and I would sit there and almost like recruit friends, like, ooh, there's a 25 or 30 year old. Let's see. Like, So it's so interesting though, to see like the huge gap in services where we're almost a forgotten demographic in cancer treatment.
How does the diagnosis that each of you have had either interrupt or change the amazing plans that you all must have for the future? Naniki?
I think for me at the time, I was trying to pursue a career in radio, and I had to almost let go of my dreams. And the reason why I did is because I had almost accepted that cancer was going to be a death sentence for me. And I almost started giving up. I didn't even want to fight my diagnosis. So for 6 months of my life, I just said, I'm not going to fight it. I'm just going to wait for D-Day. But D-Day never came. I'm still here. But what happened afterwards is that I almost had to kind of change my perspective of life. I had to dream new dreams. So radio no longer became a thing for me, but instead I still got to use my voice in doing cancer awareness around the country.
You could still do radio. I have to advocate for radio, don't I?
I still want to.
Good. Michelle in Cape Town, your own future plans.
To be honest, I had a sort of different attitude in that I was quite determined to carry on exactly as normal, which at times was to my detriment because I really didn't want to be different and I really didn't want to be a victim and I really didn't want to not be a 25-year-old living in London, living her best life, even though I clearly wasn't living my best life. So, you know, I really didn't want to be the girl with no hair in the hospital ward. So I carried on as much as I could. And I mean, I still managed to complete my master's. I got to give a speech at my valedictorian. So it was cool. I actually used it to my power. But that said, I think, you know, I kind of burnt myself out as well because I was trying to do everything and be the same person, which ultimately you're not when you're going through treatment and you're going through something like this. But it's just hard to find your group or your tribe because you don't resonate with the people in the hospital, but then you don't resonate with your friends anymore who are carrying on as normal. Yeah. So it's a tricky one. Yeah.
Savannah, your own plans for the future, have they changed at all? Have they been interrupted?
I feel like it's weird because the week before I started treatment, a lot of places in the States were lifting their mask mandates finally from the pandemic. And so I like got just a tiny taste of sweetness before I had to go back and start treatment. And I'm still in treatment. So it is really kind of hard to think of long term. I know I should be pretty good after all this, but what is normalcy? Kind of like Michelle was saying, how do you carry on normal after all this? So I started treatment without doing any type of fertility treatment just because of my own anxiety. My cancer was growing so quick that I just wanted to start. So there were things then that I had to think through really quickly. And now I'm like, did I take away my opportunity to have kids? I don't know. Is this something that I'm going to have to talk to a future partner about? Yes, obviously. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, I've almost switched from having long-term thoughts to just like, just get through this short-term. So in a way, it kind of, it didn't kill my dreams, but it just, you know, it's made me have to reconsider my time frame of goals.
Naniki and Michelle from South Africa and also Savannah from Buffalo, New York, who are all looking to the future, regardless of the time frame. I'm James Reynolds. You're listening to BBC OS Conversations on Living with Cancer from the BBC World Service.
Hallo, hier sind Julia und Chris vom Podcast Drinnies. Wir machen nicht nur einen Comedy-Podcast, sondern gehen auch leidenschaftlich gerne nicht zu Stoßzeiten in den Supermarkt. Ehrlich gesagt bleibe ich am liebsten ganz zu Hause und ziehe nur eine Hose an, wenn es klingelt. Wenn es euch auch so geht, dann ist HelloFresh genau das Richtige für euch. Der Kochbox-Lieferservice bringt euch frische, abwechslungsreiche Gerichte direkt vor die Haustür, die ihr im Handumdrehen selbst zubereiten könnt.
Und mit dem Code LECKER24 könnt ihr jetzt richtig sparen. In Deutschland bis zu 120 Euro, in Österreich bis zu 130 Euro und in der Schweiz bis zu 140 Franken. Also Code LECKER24 eingeben und sparen.
PS, der panierte Portobello-Pilz mit Sweet Chili Ketchup ist sehr gut.
People fixing the world. Brilliant solutions to the world's problems.
All right, let's do this.
We meet people with ideas to make the world a better place.
Trying new things that they're really passionate about.
And investigate whether they work.
The idea is you send in a robot where it's unsafe to send another human being.
Wow, okay.
People fixing the world from the BBC World Service.
Buckle up and get ready to ride.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Princess Catherine is 42 years old and a mother of three. In her video message, she spoke of the time it had taken to explain everything to her kids so that they felt reassured. My colleague Krupa Pardi picked up this point in our weekday OS show when she spoke from our newsroom with two young mothers in the UK. Alejandra Solis is 43, has two kids, Lydia and Oscar, and blogs about her journey with breast cancer. And firstly, Carly Musa, also a mother of two, was diagnosed with breast cancer 5 years ago at the age of 37.
My kids were 4 and 6 at the time, and I just knew how important it was to talk to them almost as quickly as possible, because when you're diagnosed, there are lots of hushed conversations and looks, and everyone's gathering suddenly.
Yeah, something that was clearly a huge matter for Kate as well. Alejandra, tell us about what happened with you and when you were diagnosed.
Quite similar, really. My kids were 7 and just turned 3 the day after my mastectomy. And I felt like the changes, obviously, in my body were quite significant and almost impossible to conceal. With the kids being so young, they would just come into the room without knocking and things like that. So we had a chat with them. Obviously, it went over Lydia's head because she was only 3. And Oscar kind of understood, asked some questions. But what was really sweet is that after a few days, his friend came over to have a play. And I've overheard them speaking. And Oscar was saying, yeah, so my mummy has a poisonous rock in her boobie. So they chopped the boobie out. But now it's bionic and it can shoot blue rays out. And I thought, fantastic. That's how his
brain is. He's a scientist overnight.
Absolutely. As they've grown, the questions and the conversations have changed, but they're quite resilient, aren't they, children?
Carly, are you able to take us back to that moment and explain the kind of language and words you used during that conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. My cancer was caught early and they were saying very good things about that and that it was going to be curative. But I thought I would talk to the therapist to find out how to talk to young children about big topics like this. And the advice I was given, I believe, was really invaluable. It was to obviously speak to them in age-appropriate language for whatever the age the children are at the time, but also to leave that conversation very open and not to say anything that you can't guarantee. And I was clear to explain to them that it was the medicine that was going to make me sick. I really wanted that to be clear because I explained it to them in a Lego analogy. I explained it that we all have cells in our body and they are meant to slot together like Lego does, like really, really well, just kind of get on with one another. But I had some bad cells that were not quite slotting together how they should. So I was going to have some really super strong medicine that was going to get those cells to behave how they are meant to behave. I think I might have said it's like a superpower medicine, but it will make me very tired because it's working really hard. I never said like, I am going to be absolutely 100% better at this time. It was not that. It was just explaining the here and now, but also to be aware that the kids were just going to say, okay, and now what are we going to do? Can I have a snack or can I have a biscuit? Yeah. And lead to further conversations down the line. There is also this thing about kids that we can sometimes think they're resilient because they just get on with something else. I think it's really important to really keep that door open and that conversation open to develop over time. And my kids now are 10 and 8, and it's changed. I got the all clear 3 years ago, but, you know, with my little girl, thank you. But, you know, my little girl went through a phase of asking me every night, do you think you're going to die tonight, mummy? Do you think you're going to die tonight? And that was years after my treatment had finished.
Alejandra, come on in here.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with that. The Lego analogy was a great idea. I wish I knew that. I think as mothers, we all try our best to keep them as sheltered as possible, but also to not kind of lie or say things we might have to take back in the end, like, yeah, we'll be fine. And I think to me, it was just about making it normal. So my daughter was obsessed with surgeries and blood and drains. And she was mostly obsessed with my prosthetic boob that I wore for a while. So much so that when her friends came over to the house, she was like, oh, can I show them their boob? And I'm like, oh my God, no, you can absolutely not show them the boob. And he's like, please, mommy, I promise. And I was like, okay, then. And she's like, look, this is my mommy's special boob. It's like, oh, wow, it comes off. Yeah, it comes off. And, you know, and just making it like part of our life, because unfortunately for me, unlike Carly, mine is stage 4. So we're in for the long haul. And I guess every day is the best day I have, assuming obviously that a cure's not found or I make a miracle recovery. But my life is pretty normal and we do most of the things quite like every family out there. There are some things I have to be more careful with than not. Like, you know, I have to be really careful with my bones, for example, because I have bone mets and osteoporosis. Now they're older, especially my 13-year-old. He's like, oh, I'll hold that bag, or oh, mommy, don't do that, or grab onto the rail or whatever, you know. So they are aware, but they also know that I am okay. And I guess because I have my hair and everything is pretty normal, you would never know if you saw me walking down the street at all.
But can I ask you a question on that, Alejandra? You've clearly both been through so much. And as you've highlighted, you have stage 4 breast cancer. And whilst you sound incredibly upbeat, incredibly positive, and full credit to you, you must have those moments where you're not as strong. And I wonder how your children receive those moments.
Look, everybody has ups and downs with or without cancer. And I think life just carries on. The kids need feeding. They need driving around to their after-school clubs. They need you for school gossip and girly drama advice and all those things. So almost cancer passes to a second kind of place because life is going on while you're dealing with all of this, which I think is actually quite nice because you think my life doesn't revolve around cancer. Yeah, I do have it, but it's something I deal with. I am not cancer. And I think it's more about your attitude towards the problem than the problem itself. So it's tough, it's unfair, it's not nice, but it's just almost like learning to play with the cards you dealt with because at the end of the day, there's nothing you can do, isn't it? It's just bad luck. And when I got diagnosed, I was at my fittest. I was doing lots of exercise. I was really healthy. Everything was going great. And you never think at 38, you can get diagnosed with terminal cancer, which is for old people, really. And then there you are. And suddenly you realize you're not alone, that there's lots of young people going through the same, and that actually some people have it worse.
Many thanks to Alejandra and to Carly with some helpful advice when talking to kids. We appreciate their time. their honesty and their real positivity that shines through. We wish them and all of our guests well. And just to add that Princess Catherine has said that she is well and she is getting stronger every day. I'm James Reynolds. You've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
People fixing the world.
Brilliant solutions to the world's problems.
All right, let's do this.
We meet people with ideas to make the world a better place.
Trying new things that they're really passionate about.
And investigate whether they work.
The idea is you send in a robot where it's unsafe to send another human being.
Wow, okay.
People fixing the world from the BBC World Service.
Buckle up and get ready to ride.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.